The story for this half hour is The Squirrel Cage by Thomas Dish. It appears in Judith Merrill's collection, England Swings SF, an Ace book. The terrifying thing, if that's what I mean, I'm not sure that terrifying is the right word, is that I'm free to write down anything I like, but that no matter what I do write down, it'll make no difference to me, to you, to whomever differences are made. But then what is meant by a difference? Is there ever really such a thing as change? I ask more questions these days than formerly. I'm less programmatic altogether. I wonder, is that a good thing? This is what it's like where I am. A chair with no back to it, so I suppose you'd call it a stool, a floor, walls, and a ceiling, which form as nearly as I can judge a cube. White, white light, no shadows, not even on the underside of the lid of the stool. Me, of course, the typewriter. I've described the typewriter at length elsewhere. Perhaps I shall describe it again. Yes, almost certainly I shall, but not now, later. But why not now? Why not the typewriter as well as anything else? Of the many kinds of questions at my disposal, why seems to be the most recurrent. Why is that? What I do is this. I stand up and walk around the room from wall to wall. It's not a large room, but it's large enough for present purposes. Sometimes I even jump, but there's little incentive to do that since there's nothing to jump for. The ceiling is quite too high to touch, and the stool is so low that it provides no challenge at all. If I thought anyone were entertained by my jumping, but I have no reason to suppose that. Sometimes I exercise, push-ups, somersaults, headstands, isometrics, but never as much as I should. I'm getting fat, disgustingly fat and full of pimples besides. I like to squeeze the pimples on my face every so often. I'll keep one sore and open with overmuch pinching in the hope that I'll develop an abscess and blood poisoning. But apparently the place is germ-proof. The thing never infects. It's well nigh impossible to kill oneself here. The walls and floor are padded, and one only gets a headache beating one's head against them. The stool and typewriter both had hard edges, but whenever I've tried to use them, they're withdrawn into the floor. That's how I know there's someone watching. Once I was convinced it was God. I assumed that this was either heaven or hell, and I imagined that it would go on for all eternity just the same way. But if I were living in eternity already, I couldn't get fatter all the time. Nothing changes in eternity. So I console myself that I will someday die. Man is mortal. I eat all I can to make that day come faster. The Times says that will give me heart disease. Eating's fun, and that's the reason I do a lot of eating. What else is there to do after all? There is this little nozzle, I suppose you'd call it, that sticks out of one wall. And all I have to do is put my mouth to it. Not the most elegant way to feed, but it tastes damn good. Sometimes I just stand there hours at a time and let it trickle in, until I have to trickle. That's what the stool's for. It has a lid on it, the stool does, which moves on a hinge. It's quite clever in a mechanical way. If I sleep, I don't seem to be aware of it. Sometimes I do catch myself dreaming, but I can never remember what they were about. I'm not able to make myself dream at will. I would like that exceedingly. That covers all the vital functions but one, and there is an accommodation for sex, too. Everything has been thought of. I have no memory of any time before this, and I cannot say how long this has been going on. According to today's New York Times, it's the 2nd of May. I don't know what conclusion one is to draw from that. From what I've been able to gather, reading the Times, my position here in this room is not typical. Prisons, for instance, seem to be run along more liberal lines usually, but perhaps the Times is lying, covering up. Perhaps even the date has been falsified. Perhaps the entire paper every day is an elaborate forgery. Or maybe they are antiques, and I am living whole centuries after they were printed, a fossil. Anything seems possible. I have no way to judge. Sometimes I make up little stories while I sit here on my stool in front of the typewriter. Sometimes they're stories about the people in the New York Times, and those are the best stories. Sometimes they're just about people I make up, but those aren't so good because, well, they're not so good because I think everybody's dead. I think I may be the only one left, sole survivor of the breed, and they just keep me here, the last one, alive in this room, this cage to look at, to observe, to make their observations of, too. I don't know why they keep me alive. And if everyone is dead, as I've supposed, then who are they, these supposed observers? Aliens? Are there aliens? I don't know. Why are they studying me? What do they hope to learn? Is it an experiment? What am I supposed to do? Are they waiting for me to say something, to write something on this typewriter? Do my responses, or lack of responses, confirm or destroy a theory of behavior? Are the testers happy with their results? They give no indications. They efface themselves, veiling themselves behind these walls, this ceiling, this floor. Perhaps no human could stand the sight of them. But maybe they are only scientists and not aliens at all. Psychologists at MIT, perhaps, such as frequently are shown in the Times. Blurred, dotty faces, bald heads, occasionally a mustache, certificate of originality. Or instead, young crew-cut army doctors studying various brainwashing techniques. Reluctantly, of course. History and a concern for freedom had forced them to violate their own privately held moral codes. Maybe I volunteered for this experiment. Is that the case? Oh, God, I hope not. Are you reading this, Professor? Or listening to it? Are you reading this, Major? Will you let me out now? I want to leave this experiment right now. Yeah, well, we've been through that little song and dance before, me and my typewriter. We've tried just about every password there is, haven't we, typewriter? And as you can see, as you can hear, here we are still. They are aliens, obviously. Sometimes I write poems. Do you like poetry? Here's one of the poems I wrote. It's called Grand Central Terminal. Grand Central Terminal is the right name for what most people wrongly call Grand Central Station. This and other priceless information comes from the New York Times. Here it is, Grand Central Terminal. How can you be unhappy when you see how high the ceiling is? My, the ceiling's high, high as the sky, so who are we to be gloomy here? Why, there isn't even room to die, my dear. This is the tomb of some giant, so great that if he ate us, there would be simply no taste. Gee, what a waste that would be of you and me. And sometimes, as you can see, I just sit here. I sit here copying old poems over again, or maybe copying the poem that the Times prints each day. The Times is my only source of poetry. Alas, the day I wrote Grand Central Terminal rather a long time ago, years. I can't say exactly how many years, though. I have no measures of time here. No day, no night, no waking and sleeping, no chronometer, but the Times ticking off its dates. I can remember dates as far back as 1957. I wish I had a little diary that I could keep here in the room with me, some record of my progress, if I could just save up my old copies of the Times. Imagine how over the years they'd pile up towers and stairways and cozy burrows of newsprint. It would be a more humane architecture, would it not? This cube that I occupy does have drawbacks from the strictly human point of view. But I'm not allowed to keep yesterday's edition. It's always taken away, whisked off, before today's edition is delivered. I should be thankful, I suppose, for what I have. What if the Times went bankrupt? What if, as is often threatened, there were a newspaper strike? Boredom is not, as you might suppose, a great problem. Eventually, very soon, in fact, boredom becomes a great challenge, a stimulus. My body. Would you be interested in my body? I used to be. I used to regret that there were no mirrors in here. Now, on the contrary, I'm grateful. How gracefully, in those early days, the flesh would wrap itself about the skeleton. Now, how it droops and languishes. I used to dance by myself, hours on end, humming my own accompaniment, leaping, rolling about, hurling myself, spread eagle against the padded walls. I became a connoisseur of kinesthesia. There's great joy in movement, free, unconstrained speed. Life's so much tamer now. Age dulls the edge of pleasure, hanging its wreaths of fat on the supple Christmas tree of youth. I have various theories about the meaning of life. Of life here. If I were somewhere else in the world I know, from the New York Times, for instance, where so many exciting things happen every day that it takes 500,000 words to tell about them, there would be no problem at all. One would be so busy running around from 53rd Street to 42nd Street, from 42nd Street to the Fulton Street Fish Market, not to mention all the journeys one might make cross town, that one wouldn't have to worry whether life had a meaning. In the daytime, one could shop for a multitude of goods. Then an evening after dinner at a fine restaurant, to the theater or cinema. Oh, life would be so full if I were living in New York. If I were free. I spend a lot of time like this, imagining what New York must be like. Imagining what other people are like. What I would be like with other people. And in a sense, my life here is full from imagining such things. One of my theories is that they, you know, ungentle listener, who they are, I'm sure. They are waiting for me to make a confession. And this poses problems. Since I remember nothing of my previous existence, I don't know what I should confess. I've tried confessing to everything, political crimes, sex crimes. I especially like to confess to sex crimes. Traffic offenses, spiritual pride. My God, what haven't I confessed to? Nothing seems to work. Perhaps I just haven't confessed to the crimes I really did commit, whatever they were. Or perhaps, which seems more and more likely, the theory's at fault. A brief hiatus. The Times came, so I read the day's news and then nourished myself at the fount of life, and now I'm back at my stool. On one of the inner pages behind the political and international news was a wonderful story, headlined, Biologists Hail Major Discovery. Let me copy it out for your benefit. Washington, D.C. Deep-sea creatures with brains but no mouths are being hailed as a major biological discovery of the 20th century. The weird animals, known as pogonophores, resemble slender worms. Unlike ordinary worms, however, they have no digestive system, no excretory organs, no means of breathing, the National Geographic Society says. Baffled scientists who first examined the pogonophores believe that only parts of the specimens had reached them. Biologists are now confident they have seen the whole animal, but still do not understand how it manages to live. Yet they know it does exist, propagate, and even think after a fashion on the floors of deep waters around the globe. The female, Pogonophore, lays up to 30 eggs at a time. A tiny brain permits rudimentary mental processes. All told, the Pogonophore is so unusual that biologists have set up a special phylum for it alone. This is significant because a phylum is such a broad biological classification that creatures as diverse as fish, reptiles, birds, and men are all included in the phylum Chordata. Settling on the sea bottom, a pogonophore secretes a tube around itself and builds it up year by year to a height of perhaps 5 feet. And the tube resembles a leaf of white grass, which may account for the fact that the animal went so long undiscovered. The pogonophore apparently never leaves its self-built prison, but crawls up and down inside at will. The worm-like animal may reach a length of 14 inches with a diameter of less than a 25th of an inch. Long tentacles wave from its top end. Zoologists once theorized that the pogonophore, in an early stage, might store enough food in its body to allow it to fast later on, but young pogonophores also lack a digestive system. It's amazing the amount of things a person can learn just by reading the Times every day. I always feel so much more alert after a good read of the paper, and creative. So herewith a story about pogonophores, striving The Memoirs of a Poganophore, Introduction. In May of 1961, I had been considering the purchase of a pet. One of my friends had recently acquired a pair of tarsiers. Another had adopted a boa constrictor, and my nocturnal roommate kept an owl caged above his desk. A nest or school of pogs was certainly one up on their eccentricities. Moreover, since poganophores do not eat, excrete, sleep, or make noise, they'd be ideal pets. In June, I had 36 shipped to me from Japan at considerable expense. A brief interruption in the story. Do you feel that it's credible? Does it possess the texture of reality? I thought that by beginning the story by mentioning those other pets, I would clothe my invention in greater verisimilitude. Were you taken in? Well, being but an indifferent biologist, I had not considered the problem of maintaining adequate pressure in my aquarium. The poganophore is used to the weight of an entire ocean. I was not equipped to meet such demands. For a few exciting days, I watched the surviving pogs rise and descend in their translucent white shells. Soon even these died. Now resigned to the commonplace, I stocked my aquarium with Maine lobster for the amusement and dinners of occasional out-of-town visitors. I have never regretted the money I spent on them. Man's rarely given to know the sublime spectacle of the rising poganophore, and then but briefly. Although I had at the time only the narrowest conception of the thoughts that passed through the rudimentary brain of the sea worm, up, 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 down, down, down. I could not help admiring its persistence. The poganophore does not sleep. He climbs to the top of the inside passage of his shell, and then when he's reached the top, he retraces his steps to the bottom of his shell. The poganophore never tires of his self-imposed regimen. He performs his duty scrupulously and with honest joy. He is not a fatalist. The memoirs that follow the introduction are not allegory. I have not tried to interpret the inner thoughts of the poganophore. There's no need for that, since the poganophore himself has given us the most eloquent record of his spiritual life. It's transcribed on the core of translucent white shell in which he spends his entire life. Since the invention of the alphabet, it's been a common conceit that the markings on shells or the sand-etched calligraphy of the journeying snail are possessed of true linguistic meaning. Cranks and eccentrics down the ages have tried to decipher these codes, just as other men have sought to understand the language of the birds. Unavailingly, I do not claim that the scrawls and shells of common shellfish can be translated. The core of the poganophore shell, however, can be, for I've broken the code. With the aid of a United States Army manual on cryptography, obtained by what devious means I'm not at liberty to reveal, I've learned that the grammar and syntax of the poganophore as a secret language. And zoologists and others who would like to verify my solution of the crypt may reach me through the editor of this publication. In all 36 cases I've been able to examine, the indented traceries on the insides of these shells have been the same. Now, it's my theory that the sole purpose of the poganophore's tentacles is to follow the course of this message up and down the core of a shell and thus, as it were, to think. The shell is a sort of externalized stream of consciousness. It would be possible, and in fact it is an almost irresistible temptation to comment on the meaning that these memoirs possess for mankind. Surely there is a philosophy compressed into these precious shells by nature herself. But before I begin my commentary, let's examine the text itself. The text. One, up, uppity, up, up, the top. Two, down, downy, down, down, thump, the bottom. Three, a description of my typewriter. The keyboard is about 1 foot wide. Each key is flush to the next and marked with a single letter of the alphabet, or with two punctuation signs, or with one number and one punctuation sign. The letters are not ordered as they are in the alphabet, alphabetically, but seemingly at random. It's possible that they are in code. Then there's a space bar. There's not, however, either a margin control or a carriage return. And Platin's not visible, and I can never see the words I'm writing. What does it all look like? Perhaps it's made immediately into a book by automatic linotypists. Wouldn't that be nice? Or perhaps my words just go on in one endless line of writing. Or perhaps this typewriter is just a fraud and leaves no record at all. Some thoughts on the subject of futility. I might just as well be lifting weights as pounding at these keys, or rolling stones up to the top of a hill from which they immediately roll back down. Yes, and I might as well tell lies as the truth. It makes no difference what I say. That is what is so terrifying. Is terrifying the right word? I seem to be feeling rather poorly today, but I've felt poorly before. In a few days, I'll be feeling all right again. I need only be patient. And then, what do they want of me here? If only I could be sure that I were serving some good purpose. I cannot help worrying about such things. Time is running out. I'm hungry again. I suspect I'm going crazy. That is the end of my story about the Pogonophores. A hiatus. Don't you worry that I'm going crazy? What if I got catatonia? Then you'd have nothing to read, nothing to listen to. Unless they gave you my copies of the New York Times, would serve you right. You, the mirror that is denied me, the shadow that I do not cast, my faithful observer who reads each freshly minted pensée, reader, listener. You, horror show monster, bug eyes, mad scientist, army major who prepares the wedding bed of my death and tempts me to it. You, other, speak to me. You. What shall I say, earthling? Aye, anything, so long as it's another voice in my own flesh that is not my own flesh, lies that I do not need to invent for myself. I'm not particular, I'm not proud, but I doubt sometimes, you won't think this is too melodramatic of me, I doubt sometimes that I'm real. You. I know the feeling. Extending the tentacle, may I, backing off later. Just now I thought we'd talk, and you begin to fade. There's so much about you that I don't understand. Your identity's not distinct. You change from one being to another as easily as I might switch channels on a television set if I had one. You're too secretive as well. You should get about in the world more. Go places. Show yourself. Enjoy life. If you're shy, I'll go out with you. You let yourself be undermined by fear, however. You? Interesting. Yes, definitely most interesting. The subject evidences acute paranoid tendencies, fantasies with almost delusional intensity. Observe his tongue, his pulse, his urine, his stools are irregular, his teeth are bad, he's losing hair. I'm losing my mind. You. He's losing his mind. I'm dying. You. He's dead. Fades until there's nothing but the golden glow, the eagle on his cap, the glint from the oak leaves on his shoulders, but he has not died in vain. His country will always remember him, for by his death he has made this nation free. Curtain. Anthem. Ah, it's me again. Surely you haven't forgotten me. Your old friend, me. Yeah. Now, listen carefully. This is my plan. I'm going to escape from this damn prison, by God, and you're going to help me. 20 people may hear and read what I write on this typewriter. And of those 20, 19 could see me rot here forever without batting an eyelash. But not number 20. Oh, no. He, she, you still has a conscience. He, she, you will send me a sign. And when I've seen the sign, I'll know that someone out there is trying to help. Oh, I won't expect miracles overnight. It may take months, years even, to work out a foolproof escape. But just the knowledge that there's someone out there trying to help will give me the strength to go on from day to day. You know what I sometimes wonder? I sometimes wonder why the Times doesn't have an editorial about me. They state their opinion on everything else. What about me? I mean, isn't it an injustice the way I'm being treated? Doesn't anybody care? And if not, why not? Don't tell me they don't know I'm here. I've been years now writing. Surely they have some idea. Surely someone does. These are serious questions. They demand serious appraisal. I insist that they be answered. I don't really expect an answer, you know. I have no false hopes left. None. I know there's no sign that'll be shown me. That even if there is, it'll be a lie. A lure to go on hoping. I know that I'm alone in my fight against this injustice. I know all that. And I don't care. My will is still unbroken, and my spirit free. From my isolation, out of the stillness, from the depths of this white, white light, I say this to you. I defy you. Do you hear that? I said, I defy you. Dinner again. What is the time I'll go to? While I was eating dinner, I had an idea for something. I was going to say here, but I seem to have forgotten what it was. If I remember, I'll jot it down. Meanwhile, I'll tell you about my other theory. My other theory is that this is a squirrel cage, you know? Like the kind you find in a small town park. You might even have one of your own, since they don't have to be very big. A squirrel cage is like most any other kind of cage, except it has an exercise wheel. The squirrel gets into the wheel and starts running. His running makes the wheel turn, and the turning of the wheel makes it necessary for him to keep running inside. The exercise is supposed to keep the squirrel healthy. What I don't understand is why they put the squirrel in the cage in the first place. Don't they know what it's like for the poor little squirrel? Or don't they care? They don't care. I remember now what it was I'd forgotten. I thought of a new story. I call it An Afternoon at the Zoo. I made it up myself. It's very short and has a moral. Here it is, An Afternoon at the Zoo. This is a story about Alexandra. Alexandra was the wife of a famous journalist who specialized in science reporting. His work took him to all parts of the country, and since they had not been blessed with children, Alexandra often accompanied him. However, this often became very boring, so she had to find something to do to pass time. If she had seen all the movies playing in the town they were in, she might go to a museum or perhaps to a ball game if she were interested in seeing a ball game that day. One day she went to a zoo. Of course, it was a small zoo because this was a small town, tasteful but not spectacular. There was a brook that meandered all around the grounds. Ducks and a lone black swan glided along the willow branches and waddled out into the lake to snap up breadcrumbs from the visitors. Alexandra thought the swan was beautiful. Then she went to a wooden building called the rodentiary. The cages advertised rabbits, otters, raccoons, etc. Inside the cages was a litter of nibbled vegetables and droppings of various shapes and colors. The animals must have been behind the wooden partition sleeping. Alexandra found this disappointing, but she told herself that rodents were hardly the most important thing to see at any zoo. Nearby the rodentiary, a black bear was sunning himself on a rock ledge. Alexandra walked all about the demi-lune of the bars without seeing other members of the bear's family. He was an enormous bear, and she watched the seals splash about in their concrete pool, and then she moved on to find a monkey house. She asked a friendly peanut vendor where it was. He told her it was closed for repairs. She said how sad. The peanut vendor said, why don't you try snakes and lizards? Alexandra wrinkled her nose in disgust. She hated reptiles ever since she was a little girl. Even though the monkey house was closed, she bought a bag of peanuts and ate them herself. The peanuts made her thirsty, so she bought a soft drink and sipped it through a straw, worrying about her weight all the while. She watched peacocks and a nervous antelope, and then she turned off onto a path that took her into a glade of trees, poplar trees, perhaps. She was alone there, so she took off her shoes and wiggled her toes or performed some equivalent action. She liked to be alone like this, sometimes. A file of heavy iron bars beyond the glade of trees drew Alexandra's attention. Inside the bars, there was a man, dressed in a loose-fitting cotton suit, pajamas most likely, held up about the waist with a sort of rope. He sat on the floor of his cage without looking at anything in particular, and the sign at the base of the fence read, Chordate. How lovely, Alexandra exclaimed. Actually, that's a very old story. I tell it in a different way every time. Sometimes it goes on from the point where I left off. Sometimes Alexandra talks to the man behind the bars. Sometimes they fall in love and she tries to help him escape. Sometimes they're both killed in the attempt. And this is very touching. Sometimes they get caught and are put behind the bars together. But because they love each other so much, imprisonment is easy to endure. That's also touching in its way. Sometimes they make it to freedom. After that, though, after they're free, I never know what to do with the story. However, I'm sure that if I were free myself, free of this cage, it would not be a problem. One part of the story doesn't make much sense. Who would put a person in a zoo? Me, for instance. Who would do such a thing? Aliens? Are we back to aliens again? Who can say about aliens? I mean, I don't know anything about them. My theory, my best theory, is that I'm being kept here by people, just ordinary people, It's an ordinary zoo, and ordinary people come by to look at me through the walls. They read the things I type on this typewriter, as it appears on a great illuminated billboard like the ones that spell out the news headlines around the sides of the Times Tower and 42nd Street. When I write something funny, they may laugh, and when I write something serious, such as an appeal for help, they probably get bored and stop reading. Or vice versa, perhaps. In any case, they don't take what I say very seriously. None of them care that I'm inside here. To them, I'm just another animal in a cage. You might object that a human being is not the same thing as an animal. But isn't he, after all? They, the spectators, seem to think so. In any case, none of them is going to help me get out. None of them thinks it's at all strange or unusual that I'm in here. None of them thinks it's wrong. That's the terrifying thing. Terrifying? It's not terrifying. How can it be? It's only a story, after all. Maybe you don't think it's a story because you're out there reading it on the billboard, but I know it's a story because I have to sit here at the stool making it up. Oh, it might have been terrifying once upon a time when I first got the idea, but I've been here now for years. Years. The story has gone on far too long. Nothing can be terrifying for years on end. I only say it's terrifying because, you know, I have to say something. Something or other. The only thing that could terrify me now is if someone were to come in. If they came in and said, "All right, you can go now." That, truly, would be terrifying. You've heard The Squirrel Cage, a story by Thomas Dish. It appears in the collection edited by Judith Merrill called England Swings SF, an Ace publication. This is Michael Hansen, technical operation for this program by Marsha Phillips.